Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? From Little Rock, Arkansas, the Salty Dogs' feel-good country music has been hailed by critics and fans alike and has been featured on TLC's Trading Spaces as well as HBO's Rectify. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to a very special edition of Tales from the South, a monthly series we call the Tin Roof Project, where well-known Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at the Joint Theater and Coffee House in the beautiful Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for this special show with dinner provided by the Argenta Market. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark can be heard on blues legend John Weston's CDs, Blues at Daybreak and Got to Deal with the Blues. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight our featured artist is Little Rock painter V.L. Cox, with these two pieces here right in the middle and this one here. This one here is called The Sugar Thief. Both are permanently part of our tale set. Our listeners can find out more about V.L.'s work at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Originally from New York, Marvin Schwartz swam for Syracuse University, where he set school records in the distance freestyle events. He stopped swimming competitively after college, but resumed at age 35 as a master's swimmer. He attended his first master's swimming national championship at age 39, and since then has been ranked in the master's swimming national top 10 every year he has competed. Marvin earned All-American status for the fastest time in the nation in 1989 in the short course 1500 meters freestyle, in 1992 for the long course 1500 meters freestyle, and in 1992 for the long course 1500 meters freestyle. He holds 8 national championship swimming titles and is a 3-time Masters long course national champion. Marvin is a member of the Little Rock, Arkansas Dolphins swim team and has been honored as the Arkansas Swimming Hall of Fame Master Swimmer of the Year. A resident of Arkansas since 1971, Marvin also earned his MFA in poetry at the University of Arkansas and has published 2 volumes of poetry and 7 books of Arkansas history. His most recent book on the history of rockabilly in Arkansas will be published by the UA Press this coming spring. He lives in Little Rock with his wife, Sandy. Tonight, Marvin is taken back in time via a black and white photograph in Midnight at the Moon. Ladies and gentlemen, Marvin Schwartz.
I sat in the living room of a home in Batesville, Arkansas, as an elderly woman turned the pages of an old photograph album. For a few moments, the only sound was the soft ticking of an antique clock on the fireplace mantel. Without a word, the gray-haired woman removed a small photo and closed the book. "That's him," she said. her eyes growing moist as she handed me the print, "My cousin, so many years ago." The photo showed a young man in a World War II era sailor's uniform. In the formal portrait, the sailor sits alone and faces the camera. He is a large man with a youthful sheen on his face, but there is a sadness in his eyes, a questioning look that suggests a deeper knowledge than he is willing to share. Looking at the photo, I thought of his days in Newport and what I knew of a Saturday night in 1955 that was Christmas Eve. That night at the Silver Moon, the most popular of Jackson County's roadhouses and the largest club in Arkansas at the time, capable of seating some 800 people, the man poured himself a drink from the whiskey bottle on his table. Over 6 feet tall and weighing more than 200 pounds, he settled his thick, muscular body into his seat. Men came by and slapped him on the shoulder, poured him more drinks from their bottles. He was Francis Callis, but his friends called him Fats. He was a 30-year-old chief petty officer based at the Millington Naval Air Station at Memphis. 5 years earlier, he had posed for his military portrait in his hometown of Batesville, where alcohol sales were prohibited. Newport had no such restrictions. Fats knocked back another drink, the whiskey adding to his sense of power. He was a judo instructor in the Navy and the toughest man in town. His exploits were common talk in the Newport bars. One story told of his cousin smashing a beer bottle on the back of his head and Fats slowly turning to say, "You better go sit down before you get me mad." Another recounted his rage at a local club when he threw chairs, tables, and the bouncer out into the front yard. Now it was nearly midnight, and the Silver Moon's house band, the Moonlighters, were on stage. They were Newport's most popular group, with local favorite Sonny Burgess on vocals and lead guitar. The Moonlighters had a wild stage show, an act they continued when the band changed its name to the Pacers, and Sonny's original songs, "Redheaded Woman" and "We Want a Boogie," became their first Sun Records hits. At the Silver Moon that night, the musicians climbed onto the bass fiddle to form a human pyramid as they played. They did the bug dance, a routine that had one of them reaching down to the stage floor, picking up an imaginary cockroach, and throwing it onto another musician who squirmed and wiggled until he threw it on someone else. As always, the band kept the Silver Moon crowd on its feet and dancing. Amidst the clamor, Fats saw his brother Tommy at a nearby table poke his fingers into another man's chest. Chairs were pushed back, and a small crowd had gathered. As many hoped, a fight was brewing. Fats walked slowly to the confrontation and faced the man who challenged his brother. A quick thrust of Fats's arms and the man went stumbling backwards, knocking over a chair as he fell. The Silver Moon bouncer, who was also a Jackson County deputy sheriff, quickly stepped in. "Stay out of this, Fats," he warned. Fats laughed and pressed on toward the fallen man, who scuttled away without rising to his feet. The band started on an encore tune, and Fats returned to his table, where men poured him more drinks. By 1 o'clock, Fats had tossed to the ground a few more men who had attempted a weak interruption of his evening's fun. The bouncer kept a cautious distance. More than 50 years later, I spoke with the Moonlighters' bass player, now an old man living in Newport, about the disastrous events of that Christmas long ago. "Fats was tougher than a nickel steak," he told me. "He was a sweet guy, but meaner than a skunk when he got drunk. When the sheriff came up, I begged Fats to go with him to the jail." Jackson County Sheriff Jake Winningham, 57 years old, and at the end of a long career in law enforcement, arrived at the Silver Moon about 2 o'clock in the morning. The bouncer had already told Fats he was under arrest. Jake repeated the order, but Fats refused to submit. "I ain't going to your dirty old jail," Fats told him. "I'll come by there tomorrow and we'll settle out." Jake knew the confrontation had to be resolved, but he also knew that Fats was not someone you could lay hands on. Another Newport elder, told me that earlier in that year, Jake had tried to force Fats's cooperation. The encounter was at Porky's Rooftop, a Newport club with a lower class clientele and a more raucous atmosphere than the Silver Moon. Months before the shooting, Fats threw Jake over a fence at Porky's and he broke his finger, the man told me. They called the state police and then put Fats in jail. The next day, Jake said to him, "You're not going to treat me like that again." Fats cried like a baby. He was a different man when he was sober. He quit drinking for several months, but when he came back to the Silver Moon, the guys would buy him drinks. He'd get stinking drunk and chase the club constable around. Fats was also well known by the prosecuting attorney for Jackson County, a man who later became a circuit judge in Central Arkansas. I met with the judge in his chambers at the Batesville Courthouse and heard more stories of the old days of drinking and fist fighting at Newport clubs. "My stepfather was the Batesville sheriff in 1949, the judge said. He once told Fats, "Don't start any problems in this county. One of us will get hurt and it won't be me." The judge also knew about Newport sheriff's encounter with Fats. "Jake Winningham was a good man, but he was scared of Fats," the judge said. "A scared man will kill you faster than a brave man." Now the encounter and its crowd of onlookers had moved outside the Silver Moon. Fats strutted around the gravel parking area, defying the officers to stop him. The club doors were locked and all external lights on the building were dark. The headlights of the police car cast a stark glare on the crowd. "Get in the car, Fats," Jake repeated, his breath forming ghost vapors in the air, his face shadowed by the white headlamps. Fats ignored him and pushed his way through the surrounding crowd. He went to his parked car and looked for something in the glove compartment. He strode back toward the sheriff, shouting, "I'll kill everybody that tries to take me to jail." As the big man stepped toward him, Jake pulled his pistol from his belt holster and shot from the hip. The sound of the gunshot exploded in the blackness of the night. The Newport Daily Independent reported that the bullet struck Fats squarely between the eyes. The sailor recoiled from the impact and staggered, then stood upright and still. The crowd stared in shocked silence as Fats fell forward, landing on his face in the gravel. Blood poured out through the hole in his brow. He pushed up, trying to stand, but kept falling back to the gravel. An ambulance was called, and Fats was taken to the Newport Hospital. He died at 5 o'clock Christmas morning, the bullet still in his cranium. More than 50 years after the shooting, I sat in the Batesville home and heard of an episode in the sailor's life never mentioned by his Newport friends. "Francis had been a loving and gentle young man," the elderly woman said. We never called him Fats. He was a tall boy, but not heavy. He had been so proud to enlist in the Navy and be a sailor, but there was a bad explosion on his ship, and he saw several of his friends blown apart. Callis's ship, the USS Honolulu, was struck by a torpedo during the 1944 Battle of Leyte Gulf, the largest naval battle in the Pacific during World War II, and the start of the American effort to reclaim the Philippine Islands from Japanese occupation. The explosion on the Honolulu killed 65 of Callis's mates. Another 5 crew members were killed when U.S. ships mistakenly fired upon the crippled Honolulu in the confusion of the battle. 19-year-old Fats was among the surviving crew members who guided the badly damaged ship to repair. The ship avoided sinking by sealing off the damaged areas in its port hull, an emergency measure that kept some of the dead sailors submerged in the warm tropical water for 2 weeks. At the conclusion of the battle, General Douglas MacArthur waded ashore at Palo Beach and proudly declared, "I have returned." Fats returned to Arkansas with 2 service ribbons and 6 bronze stars. He was a changed man. "After he came home, he began to drink and he put on weight," his relative continued. "He would come to my mother's house and talk about what he had seen. I remember him sitting in the kitchen of our house, crying when he was sober, remembering his buddies. When he drank, he quickly became angry and was easily provoked. As I sat in the Batesville home, holding the yellowing photograph, the clock on the mantel quietly ticked off the seconds as it had the night Fats was killed. At that time, little was understood about post-traumatic stress disorder, the hidden impairment that haunts combat veterans and produces self-destructive impulses and violent outbursts. For Fats and many others, tragedy and failure became the misunderstood legacy of their military service. In the years that followed the shooting, the story of Fats Kallas was often retold. As men paused in reflection on quiet afternoons and sought insight in the depths of their whiskey glasses, as vinyl discs spinning inside jukeboxes sang out mournful honky-tonk ballads of longing and loss, Fats's life became legend, frozen in his power and drunken pride, forever tossing chairs and tables through doors, forever tearing up bar fixtures from the floor like Samson carrying off the gates at Gaza. Blind with rage that fateful night, and much like blind Samson bringing down the house, Fats's death became a harbinger of what was to follow. Newport in the 1950s was for many a time of brash self-assertion and wild indulgence. In the end, order had to prevail. But who could know that time was turning for Newport? Even as it ascended in its last heyday of power and privilege, Newport's decade would pass. Farms would fail and rural communities fade. Factories would close and populations depart, and a ruined agricultural economy would desiccate Newport as it had other Delta communities. Today, the empty storefronts along once thriving Front Street bear hollow witness to that long decline. The Silver Moon and other Jackson County roadhouses are gone, and only a few white-haired men still retell the old tales of their fallen hero, the Arkansas sailor, Fats Kallas.
So thank you so much, Marvin Schwartz, for being our Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South.
Thank you so much. And of course, that's the photo.
In your story, you meet with Francis Kallas' cousin, who is now elderly. Did your meeting with her change you at all? And if so, how?
It was a very dramatic moment for me because the stories I had heard about Fats from numerous people in Newport talked about his bar exploits and him as a tough guy. What I heard from the woman who asked that her name not be revealed was that he was a full three-dimensional person. And it added a human depth to a character who was almost held up as a cartoon figure. And so as a writer, you of course want to get a deeper understanding of your characters. And when you establish that humanity between the writer and the topic of your story, not only are you able to create a better story, but it affects you as a person. And so I realized that all people have a depth that is beyond that surface appearance. And I think you can see in the suggestion in the eyes in this photo, here's a young man who is carrying a sadness. It's hidden. But I felt that, and it was an exposure, it was an opening of my eyes that amidst the wildness of Newport, which was an extraordinary town in the 1950s, there was significant human drama. There was love, there was loss, there was passion, there was emotions that may not be remembered, but if you take the time to sit with people, you will hear these stories, and they can affect you profoundly.
For our listening audience, Marvin brought a picture of Francis. This was his military picture?
That was the formal portrait of him about 5 years after the military action in the Pacific.
You know so much about this time and this place, Newport, in the 50s. Was this from researching your book? And what other stories can you share without giving too much of your book away?
Well, I can tell a lot about Newport. And there's some residents from Newport are in the audience who know the stories and live through them as well as I've researched them and can speak well to it. But I found Newport an extraordinary town. Because it is, in a sense, a microcosm of America and the Arkansas Delta. And the first thing you should know that Newport in the 1950s was much like Hot Springs in the 1920s. There was rock and roll, there was gambling, there were hookers all over this town. There was bootleg. It was wide open. And because Newport was only 90 miles from Memphis, and in Memphis, Sun Records was beginning to achieve its tremendous success. All the cats from Memphis, Elvis, Jerry Lee, Orbison, Cash, Conway Twitty, could come to Newport and play in the clubs and then get back home after the evening was over. And the thing about Newport was that it had these gigantic clubs. And the Silver Moon was an extraordinary institution, and no longer there, all burnt and gone. But in the back room were these not-so-secret gambling dens. And there were card tables and there were roulette tables. And technically, this was illegal, but there was somewhat of a laissez-faire attitude by the authorities because that had always been there. Newport had a history of an old river town going back to the frontier, the pioneer era. There were bordellos. There were all sorts of wild riverfront characters come running up the gangplanks to come into town and spend money and have fun. What happened to Newport in the 1940s during World War II, an air base was established because of Wilbur Mills, who appropriated the money. A large air base was built in Newport, double the size of the town. Training at this site was at first the Army Air Corps, then it was replaced by the Marines. The Marines were being trained in a plane called the A-25, which is a two-engine fighter bomber. It was the fastest plane in the air during World War II, the hottest plane in the air. Who would fly these planes? What we would call Top Gun pilots. Today we know the mental attitude of Top Gun pilots. They're fairly self-assured young men. So these were young men that had money in their pocket. They were looking for a place to spend it. So the smart money in Newport built these clubs. Of course, the women followed them, and the gambling was taking place. And so Newport became this riotous, wide-open town. Now, at the same time, Newport also had a very calm and controlled church community.
This is the South, after all, right? Go ahead.
And there were plenty of people that lived in Newport who never even went into the clubs. Some of them are in the audience tonight. And they're wonderful people, and they represent the tremendous agricultural heritage of Arkansas and the Delta. And so you had land-based farmers and farm families that had some of them like Schaffner and other, had whole towns named after them. They were pioneer families. You had a front street that was incredibly competitive with jam-packed with stores on Saturday afternoon. People would come in, shop. The idea, if you were a farmhand, you'd come to Newport on a Saturday. A great Saturday would meant you'd get stinking drunk, you'd chase women, and you'd go home, you know, after you had a good fight. And a big punch-up was part of your fun in the evening. And so it was an extraordinary time. There were people of every walk of life there, including baseball players like George Kell, beauty queens, politicians, rock and roll professional entertainers such as Sonny Burgess. And Sonny, for me, is the epitome of the son of a farmer. His parents weren't sharecroppers, but he grew up on a farm out in the area near Jacksonport, and his choices were very simple. When technology changed in the 1950s, and that means that tractors were coming in, and the tractors were replacing mules. So you went from manual-based agriculture to a mechanical-based agriculture. Thousands of people were displaced from their land-based livelihoods. It was called the Great Migration. Blacks and whites no longer could make a living. Some of them went to Chicago and Detroit and Flint, Michigan to work in the factories. Some went to California. Some went to cities in Arkansas and nearby. Some of them stayed on the land. What was their options on the land? Pick cotton, work in a factory if you could get a job in a factory, or if you were clever and had a little bit of talent, you'd buy yourself a Gene Autry Sears Roebuck guitar for $325 and become a rock and roller. And if you were a rock and roller, you got to play in the clubs and make more money in one night than your dad made on the farm in a week. Well, Sonny happened to come up in a family that had some uncles who were playing in rural dance shows around the countryside. In his house growing up, they listened to the Grand Ole Opry on a battery-powered radio. We talk about this going from lanterns to light bulbs. This was a time when rural electricity was first coming in to the homes in rural Jackson County, late 1940s. Sonny and his high school buddies were hired by the Jackson County Electric Cooperative to go play music at these rural shows in churches and schools, and there, Farmers Electric Co-op would tell people what it meant to have your home wired with electricity, how much it would cost, how much voltage would come down, what appliances you could buy. Think about what this means. You now had an electric pump in your well, indoor plumbing. You now had an electric refrigerator instead of a horse-drawn ice wagon bringing you a block of ice two or three times a week in the summertime. Televisions, lamps, every modern convenience that we take for granted was brand new at this time. The world was being transformed. This is a time when Sonny is a young man. He's learning his chops, his licks as a rock and roller. He's playing country music. He played music that was influenced by Hank Williams, the Wilburn Brothers, a lot of the folks from the Grand Ole Opry. And he also had a great feeling for rhythm and blues because he could hear that on the radio from Memphis. So the combination of country music and rhythm and blues creates this hybrid that we call today rockabilly. And rockabilly, as we know, evidenced by the greats Carl Perkins and Elvis, is the most infectious music you can listen. You cannot sit still when you're listening to rockabilly. Sonny was just one of these remarkable young men with talent, with insight, and he began playing music with his friends. And 60 or 70 years later, today, he's still playing music with three guys from his high school band. And these remarkable fellas are in their 80s. They're leaving, in fact, tomorrow morning, they're flying to England for a week-long concert over there. And they've been career musicians the entire time of our lifetimes, for some 70 years, representing the emergence of rock and roll, the evolution of the American art form that we call rock and roll. How many of you know the song Redheaded Woman or We Want a Boogie? Those were the first two records they recorded at Sun Studios in 1956. And they are, in my mind, national treasures. Sonny is...
What do y'all think? Do you think they're national treasures? All right, we have a few minutes here left at the end for audience questions.
What's at the location of the Silver Moon today?
The Silver Moon today is a concrete slab that's vacant. On the back end of the open space is a new building. Silver Moon burnt down in, I think it was 2007, and the owner of the property rebuilt it as a prefab metal building. It's now a senior entertainment site, alcohol, tobacco-free, and there are dances out there. But the original Silver Moon, here's an amazing story. You know, there are Elvis devotees that come from around the world. The original Silver Moon, when it was burnt, was bulldozed and pushed into a ditch. In the years that followed, Japanese tourists, the owner of the property told me this, Japanese tourists would come to the site of the destroyed Silver Moon and climb through the rubble of the ditch to find a shred of carpet where the king once danced. This is...
In your research for your book about rockabilly, did you find any story about Sun Records that didn't fit for your book, but that you just got to tell us?
Well, Sun Records was the, you know, of course, the brainchild of Sam Phillips, who happened to be in the right place at the right time. There were teenagers walking the streets of Memphis, playing their saxophones, playing their guitars, looking for a place to record. Sam was on the front edge of the technology of creating vinyl discs. So this immense surge of talent came walking into his doors. He started out as a recording service. He would, you know, if you wanted to cut a record, if you wanted to tape something, he would sell you the Vacitate. But soon, this immense talent just started showing up and knocking on his doors. And this includes Elvis and Johnny Cash and Jerry Lee Lewis. And everybody came to Memphis and had a heritage of black music. Sam was able to be on the cutting edge of a time when white musicians, of course, we're talking about some changing era of civil rights, a new technology of radio was broadcasting out. If you were within 100 miles of Memphis, you heard this rhythm and blues. So you had these young white guys whose future was either in the cotton field, in the factory, or with a guitar. And if you had a guitar and you had some talent, you went to Memphis and you wanted to get Sam's attention. So he was a remarkably bright fellow. He was also the son of sharecroppers, came from Florence, Alabama. He spoke their language. He knew what they thought. He knew how they acted. And he would turn them loose in the studio and just let it happen. And the idea was, if you made a mistake, that was part of your sound. You didn't have a second chance. There was no technology to smooth it over. So the Sun sound, which also had a little tape delay, which was through a little loop in the tape system, gave it that echo, attracted the hottest young players of the time. Elvis, Scotty Moore, Martin Willis, the saxophone player, Ace Cannon. List goes on and on. A few of these guys are still around. And then the youngsters in Arkansas would come to Memphis as well. Billy Lee Riley and Sonny Burgess and their contemporaries. Memphis was the center of rock and roll in the South. And Sam Phillips was the king of that moment. There was a question about a gentleman named Porky Sellers. And he operated another club in Newport called Porky's Rooftop. Started out as a barbecue joint along Highway 67. And then he built an open-air venue on top of the club. And then he built an enclosure on this club. And he was a great fan of Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. And he had music at the club. But here's a terrific story about Porky Sellers. His father ran a bowling alley out by the airbase during the war. Porky Sellers came up being such a great fan of music. He at one time owned a small club called the Sunset Inn. And the Sunset Inn had a reputation at Johnny Cash's drummer said it was so rough they would rent you a brick at the door before you went in. The message was when the sun went down, all hell broke loose at the Sunset Inn. That was Porky's. He cut his teeth on that. In 1942, right after Pearl Harbor occurred in 41, Porky decided that the military career wasn't his cup of tea. So he came up with a scheme to be excused from military service. He chose to rob the bank at Tupelo. With his wife and with two other gentlemen, they arranged a scheme and showed up at the home of the bank teller 11 or 12 o'clock one night, threw a false pretense, got into the home, got the bank teller to take him to the bank, left the wife in the house who was nervous wreck, smoking cigarettes, got the teller to open the vault. They got $1,100, big money in 1942, came back to the house, made the bank teller, this was like 2 in the morning, said, "Don't call the FBI, don't call the police for 4 hours," and they drove away. Sure enough, he didn't. So four hours later, he calls the police, and they finally catch up to Porky in Detroit in about a week, and they reclaim about $800 of the money. Porky spends 3 years in jail. He's dismissed from military service, but he comes back to Newport, and he opens up one of the great venues. It becomes a roadhouse, serves good barbecue. That was a day when you could drive your car right up to the barbecue, get a beer brought to your car, listen to the music from the open-air venue. And he had a rough-and-tumble club where there was a fight every 10 minutes. And everybody played there, including Sonny and Elvis and Cash and all the guys. And he also had his own band called Porky Sellers and the White River Playboys. And he was one of Newport's most colorful characters.
So how about our story and storyteller tonight? Thank you so much, Marvin Schwartz, for being on our Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South. Thank you to our live audience here at the Joint Theater and Coffee House in Argenta. Thank you to the Argenta Market for the delicious dinner, and thank you to ULR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, with additional support provided by the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you back at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
This is a song I'd written for a documentary film, and it was on the soundtrack. soundtrack to this film. It's called When My Blood Runs Cold. So be careful what you wish for. There's two jail songs back to back. I may be caged in concrete and walls. Lord knows I'm a sinner, I'm chief of them all. My days will never the number till my blood runs cold. I pray to the Lord, have mercy on my soul. I pray to the Lord, have mercy on my soul. A white suit of clothes, my name across my chest. Working in the fields, many hours without rest. I keep the good book here close by my side. My soul will move on, but my body, it will die. My soul will move on, but my body, it will die. When my blood runs cold and they lay me in the deep, I'll close my eyes and I'll give me some sleep. Where the preacher will say that I have been free. When my blood runs cold and they lay me in the deep. When my blood runs cold and they lay me in the deep. Ashamed to show my face. An honest man in Cummins here you will not find. They'll do anything, anything for a dime. They'll do anything, anything for a dime. When my blood runs cold, will say that I have been set free. When my blood runs cold and they lay me in the deep. When my blood runs cold and they lay me in the deep. When my blood runs cold and they lay me.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.